The Silver Washoe County Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife meeting today is Thursday, September 17, 2015.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Roll call, boss.
Miles Humphries Jr.
Here.
Sean Shea.
Here.
Kathy Smith.
Here.
Michelle Spencer.
Here.
William Tamlin.
Here.
We do have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go to number three. First of all, we'll just go through public comment, and then before we go into approval of minutes and stuff, we'll let the two talkers go so they can get, you guys can get done if you guys got stuff to do. So. Next thing is public comment. If anybody has anything to say about anything, please come up. If you have anything to say about anything, go ahead.
I told you to wait after Mr. Oxel talks.
If you got questions for him, yeah.
I do have questions.
Okay, yeah, then I'll just wait till afterwards.
Okay, thanks. So,
you bet. Not seeing any. Close. I'm number three. So what we'll do is we're going to swap this around a little bit. So we'll go to agenda item number 8, so informational presentation on urban wildlife conflicts by Dave Catalano. So.
Hello, I'm David Catalano. I'm a regional supervisor biologist for the Department of Wildlife. And I'm going to give a little talk, but then get out of the way.
And if anybody has any questions for him, just wait until he's done and then.
Yeah. All right, urban wildlife. So this is a pretty general definition of urban wildlife, wildlife that can live or thrive in urban environments. Some urban wildlife, such as mice, rats, and birds, are synanthropic, and the definition of that is up to the right. Ecologically associated with humans, and different types of urban areas support different kinds of wildlife, obviously. State of Nevada, we're broken up into three regions, western, eastern, and southern. We generally will work somewhat independently on urban wildlife because of the issues that we deal with. We have a seasonal variation in the call responses and volumes, and obviously the populations we're dealing with in regards to human populations. Certain areas of the state, Winnemucca, Pioche Panaca, the more rural communities, they generally seem to take care of their urban wildlife issues by themselves. And when we start getting into larger populations, people living more on the outskirts, not really familiar with living with wildlife, is when we generally start getting a lot of phone calls, varying from, obviously from birds to large mammals. In the southern region, these are primarily what they deal with. The increase in the southern region, we're starting to see a lot more activity with coyotes because a lot of the developments are moving a lot further out of town, and especially with the drought that we're having. They're being really drawn into, like the picture on the lower right there, coyote coming right into a neighborhood. And this is due to the artificial urban ecosystems that we're creating when we have our gardens, our grasses, flowers, and we're watering things, we're creating these artificial habitats. So in the southern region, obviously, they're going to deal with a lot of different things that we would hear on the western region. So they're going to be dealing with desert tortoises, a lot more of the snake issues. They're also going to be dealing with a lot more of the reptile issues, as well as you start moving further north out of the southern region, they start dealing with a lot more of the elk and antelope issues. And this is the eastern region. This is obviously up there, Elko, Ely, Eureka, Battle Mountain kind of area region. And they have a year-round urban interface with a lot of the raptors, eagles, red-tailed hawks. It's a really large migratory corridor through there. So they have calls year-round. They don't really have a really high level of calls at any particular time of the year, except for early spring when a lot of the neotropical birds are coming in and breeding. A lot of people calling in regards to small birds. Where are they? What's going on with them? Why are they, eating all my feet out of my feeder? I only want the quail. Things like that. We get a lot of interesting calls, as well as, again, the coyotes in that particular region. And that lower picture is swallows at a local building that kind of take over. And then here in our western region, primarily we have most of our calls are owls and raptors and woodpeckers, getting into some snake and reptiles and small mammals. We get a lot of rabbit calls, raccoon calls, a lot of raptors in regards to nesting along the Truckee and in trees near golf courses that we have to deal with. A lot of the young falling out of the trees, and they're very opportunistic. They will nest just about in any place that they can get a solid footing. Again, you have a lot of people living on the outskirts, and you're going to have the deer issues. That poor guy there with the Christmas lights on his head. So these are some calls that we've had to deal with in the last 2 months, just in the western region here. Our top five calls topics have been hawks and owls, and these are in the amount of calls that we've gotten. So this is in a totally lost what I was going to say, but the hawks and owls are the highest percentage of calls that we've gotten, then coyotes, birds being geese, woodpeckers, water birds, shore birds, and then obviously the deer, and then the small and medium mammals, and that includes bats. We get quite a few bat calls in the area. We've had 818 calls in July and August, equaling 360 hours of our time, and 22 calls where we've had to actually go out and respond. And those usually are raptors and owls that have been hit by a car, in somebody's house, in their building, bats and stuck on somebody's screen. It's a varying, snakes in the garage, all kinds of different reasons. We generally will only respond to issues that are of public safety. We just don't have the resource or the people power to respond to, a lot of the calls that people would like us to come respond to. We just don't have the resource. We just can't do it. These 22 calls was roughly 500 miles in 60 hours of time. And, it's very time consuming. So in this last legislative session, we got approved for two positions, two seasonal 30-hour-a-week positions. One's going to be based in Reno, and one will be based in Las Vegas. We're in the process now of getting applications and determining the interview list. These are pretty much the three things that these individuals will be working on, is just answering urban wildlife calls. That'll be going anywhere from explaining to somebody why the rabbits are eating their lettuce in the garden, to, there's a bear in my backyard. What are the next steps I take? By calling dispatch or our bat hotline. With that, there's going to be a very heavy educational component, trying to educate the public in understanding how to live with wildlife, some of the defensible things you can do to try to minimize your interaction with wildlife. Not taking your trash out the night before is a really good one. fencing off areas you don't want the wildlife. There's a ton. So they will be very involved in educating the public through, telephone communication. And when needed, they will be responding to wildlife calls and public safety concern, generally with myself or with the game warden. And that is going to be injured hawks, hawks out of nests, venomous snakes, deer that can't get out of yards, where we have a public safety issue. So, the Department of Wildlife has been dealing with urban wildlife for decades. The thing is the last several years it's really gotten elevated due to, the population in the area increasing, people living more on the outskirts, the urban, artificial urban habitats that we're creating with golf courses and parks and ponds and, everything else that we're doing, we're creating this little oasis for them. So when you start bringing in the small mammals, the mice, the rats, you're going to start bringing in the snakes, then you're going to start bringing in the raptors, then you're going to start bringing in the rabbits, and you're going to start bringing in the coyotes and the bobcats. Everything's going to follow each other in. And as you start getting larger populations further and further out, it's just going to get elevated. So that's where we are now. And so now we are trying to develop a specific urban wildlife program to help with the enormous amount of calls that we're getting. We're seeing a pretty decent increase every year during certain parts of the year. Generally from March through September are for the western region, our heavy call times, where we'll get 818 calls. And in other regions, those calls, they're going to vary. But we do get calls year-round. So, and any questions?
Nothing. So, I have a question.
Okay.
On that position, can you email that to us?
The announcement?
Yes,
just
so I missed
the
big blue.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Do
remember, you do have to identify yourself. I'm sorry.
For
the future.
For the future with urban wildlife? Yeah. Well, it's really going to depend on how these positions play out, how long this drought is going to last for us, and it's really going to depend on how well the public responds to the educational component that we're, for our urban wildlife position, getting out there and educating the public with living with wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be an evolving process. We're just starting this program. We're going to take baby steps into it, try to better understand it, and we're going to be taking public comment on it as it moves forward through phone calls, and we'll see where it morphs into. But we're hoping a big component is educating the public.
And how are you going to do that? How are you going to educate the public?
Through the person that we're hiring for the Reno position and the Las Vegas position, and then we're hoping to get somebody in the Elko position, and then from there we can hopefully add on a seasonal to each one of those to help. And they're going to be educating them through the, when a person calls and wants to know, why is there a snake coiled up in my rose bush? We're going to explain to them why it's there, and we're going to try to educate them, about how to deal with it.
But are you going to put an article in the newspaper talking about it, or have something on the web?
There will be things on our webpage, and there's already stuff on our webpage. There's a whole link on our webpage that goes into urban wildlife conflicts, and you can go into that, and there are specific files in there that says dealing with rabbits, dealing with snakes, dealing with deer, dealing with birds and woodpeckers and what have you. So you can go in there and you can read about them, raccoons and everything. You can kind of read about the animal itself, what they're after when they're coming into the urban areas, and how you may best address it, mm-hmm. Based on how far you want to go with it on your own.
So when I see,
hey, Dave.
Did you sign in?
Yeah.
No, but I'm asking a question.
Well, he needs that when he's typing your name.
I need to know who you are,
okay.
So that...
All right.
You know,
he knows. I will.
And you need to actually be addressing the board and let they respond to all of this at once, I think would be the best way.
So ask you the questions?
Ask them the questions, and then let Dave respond to everything.
All right. So
because you're talking to the board here, right? Yeah.
But you have to sign in.
So my concern is...
And then give me a name first.
Really a concern. Catherine Mosier.
M-O-S-E-R?
No. Yes. Most people spell it wrong. That's why I always say no.
I got it right.
That was a trick question.
Anyway, thank you, Catherine. And with the C or K.
K-A-T-H-R-Y-N.
Thank you. Glad I asked.
All right.
Okay.
My only question is, just how are you going to disseminate the information efficiently to the citizens? I think the website is great, but a lot of people don't, you know, especially older people, maybe they don't go on the internet that much. But they do watch the news, and they do read the newspaper. You're going to have things like that for people to look at or to understand?
Answer a little bit. I think that's one of the reasons you guys have Chris Healy.
Yes, exactly. So that will be. That's one of those parts that's going to be evolving as we start better understanding the needs of our residents and of our community on our outreach program. So that's where we will talk with our media group. We have an endow has in the conservation education, we have media, which is Chris Healy and Chris Vasey. So with them, we'll be able to, if that's an outreach we need, we can get on the channel to news and get on that. We can go to RGJ, and we've already published, well, not us personally, but they've already come and interviewed us on urban wildlife two or three times just this summer because of the increase in snake calls that they were getting, the increase in rabbit calls they were getting, several issues with the hawks over on Pembroke. So we've done a lot of those articles. But again, it's one of those things that will evolve as we start seeing what our public and what our communities are needing in regards to information. You're very welcome.
Did anybody? Yeah, you have a question, just ask me and he'll hear it.
there's some information that could be disseminated to homeowners associations. I know that I live off the Mountain Highway, and that this is Karen Dewey talking. And I think that would be an excellent resource. I know my homeowners association is very interested in reducing human wildlife conflicts. And also, I wanted to say thank you to the department for not vilifying the animal and taking a look at how humans are actually the problem and what we can do to help wildlife. Thank you.
Yeah, and I've reached out to, they've actually contacted me, and I've gone to four or five different homeowners associations and provided presentations to them in relation to their specific issues for their communities. And if a homeowners association does have a concern or wants them to come out, it's best just to contact our Conservation Education Division or myself, and we can set up a time and a place to just have an open discussion about it. So you're very welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, I just have one. Member Smith, I just have one question. Is there a component of the educational part of the information that you're giving out on the benefits of these different types of wildlife? I haven't heard that quite as much, the benefits of raptors, the benefits of snakes, the benefits of all these different animals.
Yeah, that is a component that we're going to be working on. We're going to be working on a series of brochures that we'll be able to hand out to the public when we go out on calls or when we go to some of the programs that we have at the convention center, different conventions and stuff. So we'll be able to have a series of beneficial things, why the wildlife are here and how they can benefit your community. So it'll all be in there eventually. We're working on it.
And Member Spencer, the other thing that I'm on a whole other side of it, I have two small children in school, and kids are a great way. I mean, they have firemen that come to their school. You can set that up with the Washoe County to even do, they do a lot of stuff, night meetings with parents to educate us on different things. So, you know, even as far as starting with kids when they're young, kids love to talk about animals and hear about animals. And so even if you start with them, and as they grow into adults, they can remember these things that they learned. Just like, I mean, I can remember stop, drop, and roll. I mean, I think we all learned that in school.
Yes.
So you might even talk to the Washoe County School District and see about, you know, getting into the various areas of the schools and maybe setting up, you know, meetings.
Let me think. They do that. They do that very heavily.
Yeah, and we already do that. Yeah. And I've actually got four schools I'm doing presentations at in October, because October is their Nevada Wildlife educational series. Yeah. Well, yeah, because I'm going to four, and that's going to be one of the topics. A lot of the kids want to just know about the wildlife. They know the critter they saw in their yard and tell you about it. But we do squeeze in a small section in there about living with wildlife, you know. So we kind of outreach in that sense for the kids.
Well, and if you have some information you can send to me, I'd love to pass it on to... Yeah. I work with several different schools in our area,
okay.
So I would love to pass it on to those principals, because
that
would be
great.
Yeah,
I want to send you that job announcement and stuff.
Thank you.
My email already. Yeah.
Member Humphreys, first off, I think it's a good idea for a couple part-time people to be answering the phones and educating people. But as part of an advisory board, maybe the public can recommend to us what they think would be the best possible way to get more of your information out. And one of the things that I possibly thought of is maybe, and I don't know how cost effective it would be to put in a daily issue of the RGJ, because, you know, various people, for whatever reason, in this technological world that we are in, they still don't use computers, and they get most of their media or get most of their information from media and paper. So maybe we can put a link to some of your information via RGJ, you know, a short issue with the Endow's link, and also the county board's information to where they can attend and also submit their ideas and recommendations, being as how we are an advisory board for the state commission. So...
Okay. Yeah, I'll talk to Healy about that, because I mean, it all filters through him, but you know, I don't know if you can do a weekly one, but probably maybe something every two weeks or
I'm sure a couple little lines on RGJ under some particular part throughout the paper would be highly, well, it'd be a good thing for...
A local section in the newspaper.
Yeah, right.
Slide it right in there.
Right.
Okay, I'll talk to him about that. That's a good idea.
Well, and even the news channels will pick that up. Member Spencer, even the news channels will sometimes pick that up and put it out even on media. So even if you aren't a person who reads the paper,
you get
it somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all good stuff.
Excellent.
Okay, anybody else have a question? Okay, we'll close. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
We'll close agenda item number 8. We'll move on to number 7, and we'll take you a second. Are you ready to go?
I'll just get fired up here, hopefully.
Okay, and you can guys hold your questions till afterwards. So, I appreciate it.
I didn't want to push back and squeeze you.
Ladies.
Well, thank you for the invite to come and speak to the group tonight. My name is Garth Oaksell, and I'm the project manager for the Regional Transportation Commission for the Southeast Connector. And I've been asked to come and kind of give an update on the project, specifically how it relates to wetlands and wildlife. So what I've got here is a presentation, and I do have a short video at the end, which is talks about the project's benefits to the environment. So I'll just go through these first few slides fairly quickly in order to save time for questions and discussions at the end. But one of the things I'd like to point out here is as our community grows and you take a look at the community needs. One of the things I use a lot is just think about I-580. Do we have a laser pointer? You know? Oh, here we go. The cursor came up. If you use I-580 as a north-south dividing line, and then if you drew another east-west dividing line kind of right through the northern part of the airport here, in the western side of our community, there are 13 regional roads that cross that east-west line. In the eastern side of the community, there's only 3. So the eastern side of the Truckee Meadows is very underserved by north-south routes. And if you think about Vista Boulevard, Sparks Boulevard, Pyramid Highway, they all basically dead-end at I-80. If you live in the Double Diamond area, Damani Ranch area, Curdy Ranch, Arrow Creek, any of that area is down South Reno, your only way north is basically I-580. One other thing I like to point out is where the In-N-Out Burger is, down by Virginia and I-580. If something were to happen at that interchange, the only other north-south route in the community in that area is Double R Boulevard. That's a four-lane road. So this southeast connector, when it's all built, will connect down to Mount Rose Highway up to Sparks Boulevard. So project goals, obviously we want to design or deliver a sustainable resource, blend it in with the natural environment. I'll touch on that throughout the presentation. But I think the last one there is probably the most important. I'm sure many members in the audience here are aware that the Southeast Connector has had a lot of discussions, a lot of concerns, a lot of issues with it. And we have gone through the processes to be able to deliver this project. So now it's up to us to say or do what we've said we're going to do and do what we say is in the permits. So we want to make sure that we do that so we can maintain public trust and confidence. So here's the overall project. On the left-hand side is the intersection of Sparks Boulevard on the left-hand side is South Meadows Parkway and Veterans Parkway. And then on the right-hand side is the intersection of Sparks Boulevard and Gregg Street. And I apologize, the cursor doesn't respond very quickly on this laptop, so I can point things out. But we have the whole project is 5.5 miles. You can see on the bottom part of the image there we have phase one on the right. That's the first mile that's been built. The remaining 4.5 miles is phase two, and that's what's currently under construction. So here we are on the very far south end of the project. On the left-hand side of the screen in the gray is South Meadows Parkway and Veterans Parkway. And then the roadway is the black that comes up and through the project there. That's the roadway. That kind of teal turquoise color on either side of the black line is the roadway embankment. That's one type of seed mix. And then on this screen, what is that kind of dark purple, dark maroon color down at the bottom? That's where we're doing flood volume mitigation. The entire project is in critical flood zone 1, so for every shovelful of dirt we put in for the roadway, we have to remove a shovelful. Now, why are we building the roadway up on embankment? We're doing that so if a 1997 flood event were to occur again, we would have one lane dry in each direction. And that's important in the community to allow emergency access for the eastern part. For example, just as recent as, I believe it was 2013, East McCarran Bridge was closed for a flood warning. So that severely cut off the eastern part of the community to get north and south. The Southeast Connector is designed so that we will sustain anything above a 117-year flood event. So that bridge would have stayed open if it was open to traffic. It doesn't show up here very well on the screen, but within that dark maroon purple area, there's a series of wildlife habitat islands. So this whole area, the purplish dark area, is designed to slowly drain water back to the creek. But we do have a few mounds spaced intermittently out there, and those are the wildlife habitat islands. The project removes approximately 15 trees. We're going to repurpose those trees to be used as wildlife habitat on these islands. So we will create little mounds of the stumps and branches and stuff, so burrowing animals already have something that they can go and use as habitat. And it will also just kind of break up the area from a visual standpoint. The purple is a riparian corridor seed mix, so it's a native or non-native, non-invasive seed mix that we'll have a 3-year warranty on, and then we'll continue to maintain that so that we do not allow whitetop to get back into this area. There's an artist rendering of our most southern bridge. The project in total project has 7 bridges. Phase 2 has 5 bridges. This is the southernmost one. This is a little over 500 feet long. And you see the roadway there on the right, that's Alexander Lake Road. And you see our multi-use path is that little asphalt path coming underneath the bridge and off to the bottom left-hand part of the screen. That additional opening of the bridge there is for floodwater. This is a natural choke point for floodwater coming through the Butler Ranch area. So that extra length of the bridge allows the floodwater to get to both sides of the roadway and spread out on its floodplain just like it does today. And then the next bridge that you'll see coming up allows the water to come back together. Tudor and North Butler Ranch, very similar to what we had in South Butler Ranch. On the far left side of the screen, that kind of tan rectangle trapezoid, that's the bridge we just showed you in the artist rendering. As you go to the right side of the screen, you see another tan trapezoid. That's the twin bridge of it, so the water can come back together. So on that black line running through there is the roadway. The flood water equalizes on both sides of the roadway. As we come to the right side of the screen, that's the intersection of Mira Loma. So we have an at-grade signalized intersection. Over the entire 5.5-mile project, we have two signals that we're putting in. One here at Mira Loma, that's what this is here, and then another one at Pembroke. As we go to the golf course, you can see we lose the additional color because we're not mitigating for the flood in that area. The city of Reno elected to keep Rosewood Lakes Golf Course open as a 9-hole golf course, so we could not go through there and do any flood mitigation because we would have wiped out more of the golf course holes there. We can see a couple more of the tan squares there in the middle. Those are a couple of more bridges we have within the Rosewood Lakes Golf Course area. That's to allow golfers to get to either side, as well as maintenance vehicles, and again, allow flood water to equalize on both sides. In addition to the bridges, we have over 104 large box culverts that also allow water to equalize on both sides of the roadway. Now, as we move to the north here, that's Pembroke on the right side of the screen there, another at-grade intersection. There's an artist rendering of what it looks like through the golf course, and it's kind of hard to tell, but if you look very closely in the middle of the photo, you'll see a light gray line. That's the concrete barrier for the roadway. One of the things that we heard early on in the project is people thought we were building an interstate. You know, it's going to be 20 feet high with 12, 15-foot tall sound walls, 50-foot tall mast lighting. That's not what we're building. It's a roadway. So in this general area, we're anywhere from 6 to 8 feet above the golf course. If you are familiar with that area, there's a couple of large mounds in the middle of the golf course. The roadway is actually just below the height of those mounds. So you can see we did this artist rendering to show that people will not lose the view of Peavine in the background. They not only keep their view of, you see a little white building there on the left side, that is the pepper mill. The nugget is visible over on the right. Unfortunately, I can't point out to you, but they also don't lose the view of the homes on the other side of the golf course. So now we move north of Pembroke. This is the area currently under construction. You see also an explosion of color, and it's much larger. Since we couldn't mitigate for flood volume in the golf course, we're over-mitigating for that north of Pembroke. So this large area you see here is our wetland mitigation. The project impacts about 9 acres of wetlands. Of those, about 7.5 are really wetlands. The other 2 are ag-induced. So if Butler Ranch stopped ranching their farm for a year, those wetlands would dry up. So out of the 7 to 9 acres of wetlands impact, this is an 80-acre wetland complex. So significant increase in the wetlands in our community. And I'll see if I can get the pointer to show up here while I'm talking. But Yori Drain comes across this area, and if you look kind of in the top middle of that picture, you see a kind of grayish line going down at a little bit of an angle that then comes underneath the southeast connector. That's Yori Drain. Yori Drain originates in Virginia Lake. It's the only outlet of Virginia Lake, and it seems like every summer around here you hear on the news how Virginia Lake has become an algae bloom. It gets a lot of complaints. There's a lot of urban runoff coming into there. Again, the only outlet is Yori Drain. The other concern is the waterfowl that are there. There's a lot of geese, a lot of ducks, a lot of other birds, and they poop. They poop in the water. The only outlet of Virginia Lake is Yori Drain. So Yori Drain coming out of Virginia Lake is very high in fecal coliform, or poop. Yori Drain then goes behind Costco. And if you've ever seen that ditch behind Costco, it's just an open ditch. So any runoff you have from the parking lots, whether it's spilt oil, spilt antifreeze, gasoline, big gulps, whatever the case may be, that runs off and directly into Yori Drain. Yori Drain then goes underneath the airport. In high or severe winter events, when they're de-icing the airplanes, if there's overflow of that, it's glycol is what they use, that ends up in Yori Drain as well. So right now, when Yori Drain dumps into Steamboat Creek, it's extremely polluted. Very high in fecal coliform, very high in urban runoff, including glycol. What we're going to do is once Yori Drain goes underneath the bridge up at the southeast connector, you see, the dark purple kind of blob that's very oblong going from the left to the right of the screen. Within that is kind of a light blue splotches. Those are the wetlands. If you kind of connected those light blue splotches, you can see a loop forming on the left side and then another loop forming on the right side. So what happens is Yori Drain comes underneath the bridge, hits a diversion structure, and the water splits into those north and south loops and then comes back together into Steamboat Creek. while the water's in those loops, the vegetation that's in there, the wetland plants, will uptake the fecal coliform. That's basically fertilizer. So the plants will naturally clean the water by just their uptake for nutrients. Then all the bugs, the little macro invertebrates that live in the soil, they feed off of petroleum-based products or carbon-based products, which are your oils, your antifreezes, your gasoline, your glycol. So the bugs will naturally uptake that pollutant, those pollutants. So by the time Steamboat Creek works through the, or Yorey Drain works through the North Loop and the South Loop and comes back together and dumps into Steamboat Creek, it's significantly cleaner than it is today. And that'll have benefits to the Steamboat Creek, the Truckee River, and ultimately Pyramid Lake. So huge benefit in this area, as well as wildlife habitat. And it doesn't show up on the screen very well here, but I'll touch on a couple more slides. We actually left a couple of islands out there that are going to stay at the current elevation, and I'll point out why we did that. There's an artist rendering. So on the right side of the screen, you kind of see a little ditch coming through UNR, and then it jogs over to the far right of the screen. You can see the bridge underneath the roadway. That's Yorey Drain coming across UNR Farms. So once it comes underneath that bridge on the right side of the picture is where it splits into those two loops. And that's Hidden Meadows Pond at the bottom of the screen. And just to the right of it and kind of to the top left of it, you can see where Steamboat Creek is. So some of the environmental benefits they're doing. Over 600 trees we planted with this project. At the two intersections of Mira Loma and Pembroke, we have a series, a variety of trees there, as well as rest areas. We have three rest areas along the multi-use path. We changed the design of this roadway a little bit. Most roadways you see in the community have bike lanes on either side as well as sidewalks. We figured people would not be very comfortable using bikes or walking on the sidewalks next to a six-lane wide, 45-mile-an-hour roadway. So we took the 2 5-foot bike lanes on either side, the 2 5-foot sidewalks on either side, so it's 10 foot wide on either side, combined them into one 10 foot wide multi-use path, and moved it off of the side of the road and down along on the existing ground. So that provided us a better, safe and convenient, comfortable opportunity for cyclists and people maybe running or jogging on the trail. It also reduced our footprint in the wetlands. We went from those 20 feet down to 10 feet. It also reduced our fill in the floodway, or the flood zone. So by moving that path into one and putting it down the existing road, it really had a lot of other secondary benefits. So with that, that's where those rest areas are. The other trees are going along the creek and in the wetlands to help with bank stabilization. Right now, Steamboat Creek is a very unhealthy creek. It's extremely incised, as it's called, and it has very steep banks. So when the snowmelt comes, then the floodwater rises up. It doesn't have a chance to spread out into a floodplain. It just continually erodes those banks away. So we're going to lay those banks back, reinforce some of the others, and we'll be using trees to help do that. I already talked about the 80-acre wetland complex there at Yorey Drain. It's called a polishing wetland because it's polishing clean the water between the vegetation and the bugs. And then that 1 1/3 miles of steamboat or of creek bank stabilization, that helps with further erosion downstream. And then the 89 acres right at Perry Corridor, those are those first two photos I showed you with the purple area and the wildlife islands on the very south end of the project. So 80 plus roughly 90, you're looking at 170 acres of environmental enhancements that are attached to this project. So now we'll get into some of the wildlife-specific design features. We've got undercrossings, fencing, cattle guards, and these power poultry main, and I've got some photos of these to show you what we're looking at. So the wildlife undercrossings. We've got the Veterans Memorial Bridge that's built. Early on in the process, people were concerned that the deer that's out there, there's a very nice, healthy deer herd out there, very beautiful, that they'd be cut off for access to get down to UNR Farms and back up into the mountains. We knew that would not be the case because of how big the bridge opening is, and you can see here the deer are there, and they're utilizing the bridge. In fact, they love it in the summertime. It's a huge shade opportunity for them. So in the summertime, in the heat of the day, the deer are laying there underneath the bridge. And there you can see a couple of bucks and the does enjoying the water and the shade in that area. And then we also, with all those box culverts, I just took this picture this morning. I went into one of the box culverts there, and you can see we've got wildlife footprints. So they're utilizing the box culverts as well for undercrossings of the roadway. So between the bridges and the box culverts, we have plenty of opportunities for wildlife to move east and west on either side of the road. Then we have the wildlife fence pictured there on the left. It's 8 feet tall. What doesn't show up very well in the picture is actually graduated openings. So at the bottom of that fence, the openings are very small, and they get larger as you get towards the top. And that's obviously, we want the smaller openings for the marmots and the rabbits and stuff to keep them off the road so they don't become a safety issue to people or even to themselves. And we've seen that work during construction. We actually had a buck come up to it and tried to jump over it. His shoulders hit the fence, and he went back down and just walked around. We didn't have the total fence built yet, so he was able to walk around to get to where he wanted to be. On the right-hand side, our first line of defense is to keep wildlife out. If they do happen to get on the wrong side of the fence, what you see on the right there in that picture is a one-way wildlife gate. And in the video I'll show later, you'll see how that actually operates. Then we went with a double cattle guard on Clean Water Way. Because of the deer population, we didn't feel it was prudent to go with a single cattle guard, which would have been between those two concrete pieces you see there crossing the road. It would have been half the size of that, because the deer could just jump over a single cattle guard. So we went with a double cattle guard, and we went with round tubes. This was a design we took from Texas. We reached out. The consultant we had is an international consultant, so they were able to reach out to some of their other partner offices, and they came across this design from Texas. So we put these round tubes. Now, why did we do round tubes? During our research, we came across that deer can walk across normal cattle guards, because normal cattle guards are a square tube, and the hooves of deer are very small. So they're able to just basically kind of tiptoe across square tube cattle guards. So we went with the round tubes here so they wouldn't have that opportunity again to protect them and keep them off the roadway. Power poles. I mentioned those seven power poles we're leaving. That's what's pictured in the right side of the screen. So we did have to relocate a power line in this area, but we told NV Energy to please leave the power poles up, because in earlier conversations with Lahontan Audubon Society, they recognized that these wetlands would be a benefit for birdwatching community. And a couple of comments were made about, well, it's too bad that power line's going away, because that's, you know, birds like to hang out up there. And we said, well, let's see what we can do. So we've worked with NV Energy to leave the power poles there. So there's seven of those that are left in place, and we chose the seven that are furthest away from the roadway to try to minimize the bird-vehicle, you know, conflicts that occur. On the left side of the screen, the power lines you see on the right side of the picture to the left is NV Energy's permanent relocation of those power lines. And what I'd like to point out is their power poles, if you look there, are just very vertical. There's not that cross member. Versus, again, in the left picture, the left image, you see that cross member up top. The left power pole are ones that Granite Construction installed temporarily for construction. Instead of having to run generators and water pumps and stuff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we have our own little mini power grid on the project site. So they can tap in anywhere within the project, just plug in electrically to run their pumps, to reduce air emissions as well as noise while we're under construction. So what Granite did is when they talked with NV Energy about doing this temporary power grid, they said, can we do raptor-friendly power poles? And that's what you see there on the left. That's a raptor-friendly cross member up there, because it spreads the wires further out from each other, so the raptors have a safe place to perch. So wildlife-specific construction features. We have an avian and bat protection plan. That was part of our 404 permit application. It's very specific on what we can do and what we can't do. It calls for bird surveys all the time. This is a photo from phase one. We encountered a killdeer nest. You can see in the picture on the right-hand side are the four eggs. We had to delay the opening of the multi-use path or the Truckee River bike path by 4 weeks, because this nest was right where the path was going to go. In fact, the next slide I have is a video shot of the image, and I can show you the picture there. So then we go to phase two, and we've done 9 separate bird surveys on phase two this summer. And this was one of our very first ones, where there's an old blackwood or a black cottonwood out there with a lot of hollows in it. So we were out there with our wildlife biologist with the man lift, as you can see, going up each one of those hollows, taking pictures inside, going back down, showing the photos to the wildlife biologist. They said, no, there's no nesting activity. We'd go back up, we'd put this wire mesh over that hollow. So we think there's about 12 different cavities on that tree that we went and verified and made sure. So that was all part of that avian and bat protection plan. Now this next image, I apologize, my pointer isn't working, but I'll just kind of give here. This is kind of this. We did a time-lapse photography of phase one. So this was a still shot of the project. That killdeer nest is right here. And you can see these construction cones here, here, there, there, here, here, and it loops up. That was the buffer that we had to create around the killdeer. And you can see in the background, we're planting trees, there's a piece of equipment there, we're doing grading all outside of that buffer. In fact, that little piece of fence sat there for 4 weeks. That's how much the contractor and everyone else followed the stipulations there. We wouldn't even cross this buffer to go in and get that piece of construction fence, which was used to keep trespassers off the bridge. So for that 4 weeks, that was a complete no-go zone. And like I said, that delayed us opening the multi-use path in that area by about 4 weeks so we could allow the eggs to hatch and the little ones to mature enough so they could get out on their own. Now, during also wildlife-specific construction, it's kind of hard to see, but there's a little gully just going straight through this picture. We have a series of or a bunch of excavations out there as part of this project, and we also know there's wildlife in there. So Granite built these wildlife ramps, and that's a little ramp that goes down to the bottom of the excavation that's at a less steep angle so the wildlife can just walk out. So any rabbits, marmots, deer, whatever, snakes that go down in that excavation, they have, there's actually four ramps surrounding this that they have a ramp to be able to get out safely and not be trapped down inside there. We also have a roadkill avoidance and management program. I did not take a picture of any roadkill. I figure that probably wouldn't be something people want to look at, but we came up with this because we noticed that along Clean Water Way, they weren't construction vehicles, but trucks going out to the treatment plant were hitting marmots. Turkey vultures were then coming in to eat the roadkill. Turkey vultures are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So we were concerned that a turkey vulture eating the marmot could get struck by a vehicle. So we came up with this roadkill avoidance and management program standard operating procedure that tells us what to do if we encounter roadkill. And that's, I mean, just part of the level of effort we've gone to help protect the wildlife in this area. So that concludes the PowerPoint aspect of this. I'll bring up the video real quick and see if the sound will be loud enough here. That's as loud as it goes. Can everyone hear that okay? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Yeah, okay.
Side of the fence, RTC has a contingency plan. deer or the horse is just able to simply walk right through that gate, but yet not be able to get back through when they're on the correct side.
A cattle guard that's double wide is also preventing animals from getting on the roadway.
The deer are able to tiptoe across the normal square tubed cattle guard because of their smaller hooks. So we went with this round tube design.
Animals still easily reach the other side of the roadway by walking under the Veterans Memorial Bridge. With plans to manage animals, plants, and water, RTC's Southeast Connector project is helping restore this area to more of a natural, pristine state. The Southeast Connector is slated to be finished in 2017.
That's pretty much it. The rest of it is just kind of wrap up about where you can get additional information on the project, which I've got in the slide here for the presentation as well. Let me double check here. Yeah. I think I've got a couple things on another community asset that I'll touch up on the very end. But at this point, if you want to do questions or...
Well, I'd rather you...
Okay, but then what we've got here is at the intersection of Sparks Boulevard and Gregg Street is going to be the Nevada Veterans Memorial Plaza. And it's something that's being spearheaded by Sparks City Council member Ron Smith, as well as another number of other community folks, including the Gold Star Families and Blue Star Mothers. They're doing a fundraiser. It's all going to be 100% funded through community donations. And this is an artist rendering of what that plaza will look like. Again, what I'm handing you here is some additional information on the project, a website that you can go to. We're selling bricks where you can honor... perhaps there's a service member in your family that you would like to honor. They're selling bricks. The small ones are $100. The larger ones are $250, and then I believe they have another size that's $500. Our first fundraising opportunity is a week from tomorrow. It's a dinner. We've got two generals coming into town, General Herbert and Michael. Who's the other general?
John Abizat.
Yeah,
John Abizat, former commander of the U.S. Central.
Yeah, he'll be our keynote speaker. Very exciting to have him be able to come here and speak to the community. There's tables available. There are seats available. The time is running out. We actually had a meeting this afternoon going over the final details of this. And if you're interested in going, I encourage you to sign up as soon as possible because we are literally at the point of do we add another row of tables or do we not? So if we don't want to have a mad dash of adding a row of tables with having a lot of people sign up at the last minute. There'll be a silent auction there. Right now we have over 40 gifts that have been donated by the community. Some of them are very substantial gifts and opportunities. So I encourage you to go on the website, learn more about that, and be a part of this opportunity here. So this wraps it up here. This is my contact information. That's my email and my direct phone number. We also have a project website called southeastconnector.com. You can go on there and get all sorts of information as well as sign up for weekly updates. We give updates on where we're at with construction or other kind of unique aspects of the project. And then again, the RTC has a very good presence on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. So if you have any of those accounts, make sure to sign up for that because we also update on just other things that the RTC does throughout the community.
Before any questions, I don't know how long you can stay, Gart, but if somebody's got a lot of questions,
maybe they can go in the other room. And there's no yelling at them. If somebody comes in here to start yelling at them, you're going to go out the door. So please be courteous.
You know each other, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, no, I wasn't talking about you. I don't know. We never see anybody come to these. So all these are all new faces, to be honest with you. So if anybody has any quick questions for him that might be for everybody, please be brief. And
my name's Wayne Sievers. I'm the treasurer for Hidden Meadows HOA. Garth, would you agree that there's a federal court case pending right now that may require an environmental impact statement to be done or for the route to be changed?
Yes, the Upper Southeast Communities Coalition filed a lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers regarding the issuance of the RTC receiving a 404 permit, which allows for fill in wetlands or, fill or excavation of wetlands. That was first heard in the Eastern California District Court in Sacramento. The first step of that was to seek a preliminary injunction, which would stop construction. That was denied. There was then a court hearing date where the judge ruled in favor of the Army Corps of Engineers, i.e. RTC. We intervened because obviously we had a very large interest in the outcome of that case. That was appealed to the appellate court in San Francisco. Another motion for an injunction was heard. The injunction went back to the district court. Again, it was denied. It went to the appellate court. The appellate court denied the injunction, which is why we are still able to continue with construction. But we do have a court date on October 18th in front of the appellate court in San Francisco, where they will hear on the merits of whether the judge at the Ninth Circuit District Court, thank you, ruled appropriately on the matter of law. It isn't so much in San Francisco about the project itself, it's whether the judge in Sacramento appropriately applied previous court cases and matters of the law.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
October 19th, sorry, yeah. 18th is when we go over there. That's a Sunday. 19th is a Monday.
Rex?
Rex Plows. On these wetlands that you are creating, are they all natural? Will they need to be maintained? If they are, who maintains them? And are you contracting with another department within the state for a period of time, or how is that being handled?
Okay, good question. So the wetlands are not natural because we're constructing them, much like the wetlands in the golf course were constructed as part of the golf course. We have it in our contract with Granite Construction. They have a 3-year warranty on that. So we have 2 years of construction, then a 3-year warranty. So that's basically 5 years. We also have a 10-year monitoring time frame with the Army Corps of Engineers that we have to meet certain success criteria for the wetlands. A lot of that is that the hydrology, the water is flowing appropriately, the vegetation is growing, they have a certain percentage of cover, also showing that the vegetation is repopulating or repollinating itself so it does become natural. So the idea is for the first couple years, we're babying the wetlands. We're watching them very, very closely. After we start getting some time, the human presence starts backing off because one of the things the Corps requires is you have 3 years of no human intervention. Those wetlands are completely now natural. They're on their own. Where the wetlands are located is on property owned by the RTC. We have in our 404 permit stipulations that we will maintain those wetlands and be the owners of them. We offer to the Corps to deed restrict that land. So it will be recorded with the Washoe County Recorder's Office as deed restriction, meaning nothing can be built there. There's other stipulations of if we want to turn it over to, say, Washoe County Open Parks, we might do that. But right now, the RTC, we have it in our budget to maintain these every year. We maintain little isolated pieces of property all throughout the community. So we would just add this maintenance to it. We anticipate, because it has to be no human intervention and natural, maybe some occasional trash removal. Maybe some occasional little white tops popping up somewhere over in a corner. We'll go take care of that. But for the most part, these are going to be natural and self-sustaining.
Okay. Anybody else? You have another question?
Yes, I do. I have a couple. Where the Yorey Drain comes in, you explain to these people that our homeowners association has a 17-acre pond. You even said 17-acre, but we have a 17-acre pond there.
Okay.
Yorey Drain comes in into the Steamboat Creek. This last week, there's been a collar put there at the end of Yorey Drain, kind of like one to catch oil spill or
yes.
Something. Is that just something that was an afterthought, or what's going
no,
on there?
That's a turbidity curtain, and what that does is if we accidentally drop anything into Yorey Drain, whether it be soil, a Coke bottle, an oil spill, anything that could go into the creek, that turbidity curtain stops. We actually have three of them. There's a total of three turbidity curtains in Yorey Drain. Two is the requirement per the 401 permit, as well as the working and waterways permit that we acquired from NDEP. Granite went in and added a third one. Again, Granite is really stepping up to the plate on this project from an environmental standpoint.
The third one was ours, because we hadn't seen it.
The first two were further upstream. Yes, we added a third one here just this week.
On our 17-acre lake or pond, the water is decreasing to it. We've never seen it this low. Mm-hmm. In fact, now we're seeing growth of weeds coming up through it. Are you guys monitoring that or doing anything about it or what?
No, because we are not changing any flows at all in any of the structures. What's coming through Yorey Drain continues to go through Yorey Drain. What's coming down Steamboat Creek continues to come down Steamboat Creek. I mean, our community in general, the water is severely low. I think it's a matter of a coincidence on that one, but we are not taking any water out of the drain or the creek. We're not allowed to do that.
During the last 6 months, I was our road goes right next to Steamboat Creek. I found a barn owl, and I brought it over to your biologist to see what caused the death, whether it was a construction-related thing. I never heard back. I don't know if they report to you on things like that or not.
No, you could actually probably call them. They actually have a vet area that does specific things like that off of, I think they're in Sparks.
No, they're over here. Because I dropped the carcass off here.
Yeah, but they're...
I did talk to a guy, and he said, yeah, you got the carcass, let's go look at it.
Their lab is in the Sparks by the Sparks maintenance station. It kind of sits back over there. So I would call and ask to talk to the state vet. That's where she's at. Go ahead.
One of the things that I found out is that when Rosewood Lake...
What's your name?
Daryl Harwell with Nevada Waterfowl Association.
Thank you.
Rosewood Lake was bought by the airport authorities June of 1991. At the time, they had 60 acre-feet of wetlands in the Rosewood Lake area and 92 acre-feet of land where they developed the golf course. So when you start talking about this roadway going through, that they're only impacting 11.45 of the wetlands, I find it hard to believe that when you have 60, you're only going to impact 11.45. Some of the things that I know for a fact, being a Hidden Valley resident, that this year alone, there was 150 speckled-bellied geese, 250 widgeon, 450 Canadian geese that was pretty much on the main waterway right by the golf course. Even if the road misses that main waterway and it's open, I mean, right now there's 500 geese sitting on that waterway. So, I mean, they're going to still continue to fly in that waterway. And it's going to be low to the ground, doing 45 miles an hour. Yep, we're going to have some roadkill.
So you have no question. You just want to state
it. With 60 acre-feet of water, they're only going to build 80 acre-feet of water. And then his comment that Granite will keep it for 3 years, that RTC is going to keep it for 10, but the last 3 years, they've got to have a hands-off on a wetland that they're building. Who's gonna knock down the like he says, white top? But let's talk about cattails. You know, the food. I mean, we're gonna have Seiko in these ponds. I mean, what's the habitat around these ponds? What's the habitat in these ponds? I don't hear any of this, and it sounds like Granite's biologist is designing the wetlands. According to Jack Robb, nobody from the Department of Wildlife has put any insight on how to build the wetlands. So, I mean, Granite, they got this biologist, but how many wetlands has he built? And my biggest concern, and we have never decided, is I do not want this wetlands turned over to the Department of Transportation because of the mitigation, because we know what they've done at the south end of Washoe Lake is terrible.
Okay, you want to add?
There's a lot of things you brought up that I'd like to point out or clarify. The 11.45 acres you mentioned is what's in our permit application, but that's all waters of the U.S. Wetlands is actually right on 7, because that 11.45 includes ponds, streams, and other things that are waters of the U.S. So it's really only about 7 acres of wetlands that are being impacted. Now, in the golf course, you mentioned that there's 60 acres in the golf course, and how could we build the road through that are not impacted? Part of the reason is when we picked an alignment, we went fairway to fairway to fairway because we knew we had to avoid the wetlands. It's, again, hard to see on here, and unfortunately, this cursor doesn't show up, but if you look in the golf course, you see kind of a green rectangle in the golf course area there. That is a very large, that is over the top of a very large wetland complex in the golf course that the road completely avoids. So we specifically went from fairway to fairway, tee box to tee box, green to green to avoid the wetlands. So in the golf course itself, we're actually only impacting roughly 5.5 acres of wetlands in the golf course because, again, we impact the golf course, not the wetlands. Granite is not designing the wetlands. That was CH2M Hill. We went out for request proposals. stated these are the things we need, wetlands being a major part of that. They assembled the best experts that they had, put together a proposal. That proposal was evaluated by a number of community members. They were ranked, they were interviewed, and they were selected. CH2M Hill is a large international company. They have done wetlands and environmental restoration projects all throughout the world. They have their people input on this. We did talk to Endow regarding raptors. We actually met with them out in person because of the issue with the bald eagle tree and the hawks in the area. U.S. Fish and Wildlife was with us there as well. As far as wetlands designs, because the Army Corps has jurisdiction over the wetlands, they were the ones that reviewed our wetlands design and our mitigation plan. Regarding the 3 years versus 10 years versus who's after that, those are all just contractual items. The 3 years is contractual with Granite, that they have a warranty, that if any plants fail in that 3 years, they have to come back and replant them, and then that starts a new three-year clock. So it's still the RTC that has responsibility, but Granite has the financial commitment on it to warranty the vegetation that's out there. The 10 years is a 404 requirement by the Army Corps of Engineers. That 10 years, it could be 15, it could be 7, it could be 12. The 10 years is just a figure on the 404, or a number on the 404 document right now. The key item on that, and it's just a coincidence, is 3 years of no human intervention. That could be years 8, 9, and 10. It could be years 6, 7, and 8. It could be years 13, 14, 15. We don't know. But right now, it's 10 years is what we're on the hook for with the 404 permit. And again, RTC owns the land. We're committed to owning it. We're going to deed restrict it. We've already budgeted for maintenance in those outlying years. Right now, the maintenance is part of my contract because it's a warranty with Granite. I believe I hit on all the items on there.
I think so.
So, Member Spencer, and I will just say the geese, Rosewood Lakes Golf Course, every single year when they do the Goose Roundup, the Wildlife Services, they pull geese from there every year because it's in the flight path of the airport. So
yeah.
You see a lot of them today, but guess what? Next June, they'll remove them because they call every year because that's not good for the golf course. I'm just saying.
Hey. And that is a good point with the airport, with the bird habitat. We did get input from the airport as well as far as what their measures are to reduce waterfowl. In fact, I think City of Reno went through a major effort with that with Virginia Lake to help reduce waterfowl in Virginia Lake because of the concern with the airport. So.
Actually, I have. Actually, anybody else have any questions?
It's not that shape, by the way.
Okay.
Say that it is, so you're not going to talk.
Member yeah. Shea? I got just two questions for you. One thing that concerned me that you didn't hit a lot on was you mentioned rest areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I find rest areas, if you explain that a little bit, because I find rest areas places people over and throw junk out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's anywhere you look. So I see a pollution problem just from your rest areas, and it didn't show where the rest areas are.
Right. I apologize, the cursor doesn't show up soon enough, but they're on the multi-use path. So they're not the roadway. It's
okay.
Multi-use path rest areas. There are three of them. It's basically a couple of benches, a couple of trash receptacles, and we've talked about a doggy dispenser pickup bag.
Okay.
And talking with the local park and recs folks, what they found was more successful is a kind of take a bag, leave a bag, your shopping bags. Those black ones you pull out of dispensers, a lot of HOA place them, are extremely expensive. The park and recs have started doing a take a bag, leave a bag. So if you're a dog owner, they ask you to carry a couple of bags, drop them in. So they are in the multi-use path. There are trash receptacles in those locations. But, yeah, potentially people could dispose of trash there, but we have amenities to encourage them not to just throw it off on the side of the road. So where they are, there's one north of Pembroke in the UNR area,
okay.
And then two down in the Butler Ranch area, so south of Miraval.
Okay. Who's in charge of picking the garbage up?
In that instance, north of Pembroke would be City of Sparks. That's their sphere of influence. And then the Miraval area would be City of Reno.
And will they have to drive a bike down that path?
No, we designed the multi-use path. That was part of our coordination with them. The multi-use path, again, being 10-foot wide, very similar to the Truckee River Trail
okay.
that both Reno and Sparks maintain. So they have a smaller little Cushman device that, you know, that it's not a full-size vehicle, but it's not a go-kart.
Okay.
Okay. In between, yeah.
Then my second question was, you know the flexible deer fence, so if they're in, they can get out, it works out.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've seen, do those flex down?
No, they flex out.
Yeah, but do they flex down? Because what it is you got them too short. I've seen deer on I-80 have gotten tried and jump that. They come up to it, and they don't like that push. They try and jump it. A foot slides down between a couple of them, and they're hung upside down. So, because you do have that gap between that wood and that, I've noticed that if you go all the way to the top, they got a tendency to look, and then they look down and they go okay. forward.
Well, so we'll take a look at that, because I think we could add that pretty easily, because those yeah. beams go all the way up.
Yeah, and that's what I thought. And that's just, yeah. you know, you're going to get a ration of stuff if there's a deer hanging there.
That was a standard detail we took from NDOT as well as Idaho DOT. So we'll take a look at that and see.
Yeah, just because I've seen it, and I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, makes sense.
Anything else? Member Smith, I just have one quick question. I read a little bit about the methylmercury, and I know that you guys are planning on encasing it in cement and all that. Is there any requirement for testing downstream?
Yes.
And if how long does that go on, and is there a requirement for cleanup and all that?
Yeah, so the monitoring of the water is continuous throughout construction. We're actually doing monitoring now, even though we're not working in the areas of mercury, in order to get background data, because that's one of the things that there's some data out there for how much mercury is coming down the pipe, but not a lot. So we're pulling water samples right now of how much mercury is there, and we have in the not only in the 404 permit, but also the 401 permit, which is a water quality certification that we got from Nevada Department of Environmental Protection. Both of those hit on mercury, and we had to come up with a sampling analysis plan that talks about how we're going to monitor it, what happens if we get a high reading, what do we do after that? So there is a very robust procedure for how everything occurs, as well as a dewatering plan for how we're going to keep the creek off of the construction site. And that's first and foremost the way we handle the mercury is there. We don't let it get into the creek by keeping the creek over there and the construction over here. Does that kind of answer your question? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess is there a time period after you finished that it's still going
yeah,
to
the
be
monitoring, I forget what it was, but I think it might be a year after construction we continue to monitor the water. The thought being at that point, we're not doing anything that's stirred up the mercury. It's encapsulated in the roadway. Any mercury that's coming now in the system is coming from Washoe Lake or coming from something upstream. So we're monitoring at the project limits upstream and almost the project limits downstream. It's just where the Clean Waterway Bridge is was the next logical spot to pull a water sample.
Anybody else?
Member Humphreys, first off, Garth, very good on the presentation. Seems like RTC has actually put pretty good effort into this. And one of my questions is, after the 10-year is up, who eventually, you know, overlooks it throughout the years, you know, because various projects with other places and wetlands, it's been very nil on their upkeep and their vows to and promises to maintain what their obligations were in the first place. So after that 10-year, who basically are you guys turning it over to, and who's going to be taking care of it?
Right. So as it sits right now, the RTC will continue with ownership of that. We've had preliminary discussions with Washoe County as well as City of Reno and City of Sparks for their park and rec folks or their open space folks. At the time we had those conversations, we were deep in the recession. There was no way they were taking on any more responsibilities. We said, we understand, we sympathize with you, you know, we'll keep it. 10 years from now, 8 years, 12 years from now, at this point, RTC, we're the owners. We're the title owners. The Army Corps can come back at us for violations, so we're on the hook. But if, for some reason, if Washoe County Parks and Open Space would like to take that underneath their asset, they could do that. But I think a key part of that would be a funding source. But again, keep in mind that when these are done, they're natural. The funding should be occasional trash. One other thing real quick we did was this is an interesting federal versus county issue. You know, Washoe County has vector control for mosquitoes. So they had concerns with some of the ponds we were creating in the wetlands and as well as other areas that those were going to be mosquito breeding grounds. So we went to the Corps and said, hey, this is an issue. And we said, well, we know that, but what Washoe County does to handle that's not natural. So we went back to Washoe County and said, the Corps is not going to let us do this. Finally, at the end of the day, we were able to come to an agreement that we will have solar-powered bubblers out there in the open water just to help ripple the surface so it, for vector control. The Army Corps of Engineers, to their credit, were the ones that relented, and they said that's not natural, but we recognize the unique issue you have here in your community, so we'll allow those solar-powered bubblers.
Do you have one more question?
Catherine Mosier.
mentioned the bald eagle tree. Mm-hmm. What is the fate of the bald eagle tree?
Unfortunately, the bald eagle tree comes down. It could. What's that?
Need to replace it with something?
Not at that particular location, because part of that, as you know, this gentleman alluded to, the concern with bird strikes, is we're trying to keep any trees we plant, other than right at the intersections, further away from the roadway to avoid what's happened on I-580. I know a couple of times where they had the high mass light on one side and wetlands on the other, and the hawks swoop down and get hit. So, you know, being perfectly blunt, that tree could stay, but it's in a very risky location that it puts wildlife at risk as well as golfers, because it's when the project is done, we're afraid the root system could be disturbed enough that the tree would fall over. So from a safety standpoint, it's being removed. And we'll repurpose that for the wildlife habitat down on the south end of the project.
Okay. Not seeing any more. I just want to thank you very much. That was very good.
My
very
pleasure.
Good.
And like I said, the contact information is up there. If anything comes up, you think of something later tonight, tomorrow, feel free to drop me an email, call my desk directly, and I'll be more than happy to talk.
All right. Thank you very much, Garth.
Thank you so much.
Are you guys done with this?
Oh, yeah. We'll close number seven. Let's take a break for just a second. And that'll let. We'll be back in. How about. Okay, let's go
for
item number four, approval of the July 30th minutes.
Tabman will make a motion.
Slow down. I'll take it out to the public. Anybody has anything? I'm not seeing it. I'll bring it back to the board.
There was one thing that I've seen, and it's the
that you saw.
Page paragraph
that I saw. It was
I'm so sorry.
It was the very last page, and it's when Karen Talo, at the very end, it says, Miss Talo believes that the only nuisance animals are of two rather legged than four-legged.
Two-legged
rather than four-legged.
Oh,
okay. We got it.
Okay.
I'll fix it.
Anybody else? Somebody want to make a motion?
You want me to make a motion?
Yeah.
Tamlin will make a motion to approve the minutes as submitted.
As amended?
As amended, excuse me.
Thank you, sir.
Member Shales.
Go ahead.
Member Shales, second that.
We're ready tonight.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Okay. Number four. Go to number five. Board member meeting assignments. A discussion.
25th and 26th of September. Who's going?
That is Las Vegas, and that's Las Vegas man on the end.
That would be Mr. Humphreys.
Junior. It says I put it on there. You better say it.
And then for the November 13th and 14th in Reno, I will go. And
I'll be there too.
Yeah, so whoever wants to go, since it's here in Reno.
But
I'll go too. So
just remember, you can't talk business when you're there amongst yourselves.
Oh, well,
yeah.
There's four of them going.
We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see who shows up.
Don't make Jen have to show up.
No shop talk.
Okay.
All right.
And then I want to mention something on the November. Our meeting's on the 5th, I believe.
Yep.
So, Miles, be prepared just in case I cannot make it back. So, I'll help you out beforehand, but I'm hoping to be back that day. So, just so you guys.
We'll help you.
Okay.
Clearly, I'm good at correcting you already.
Peace, King.
Oh, man.
And I'm
going to
Boston Yacht.
I know, yeah, we just Robert.
Okay.
We'll get through it.
So I think that's good for number five. We'll go to number six. Community member and liaison updates, correspondence, including sportsmen's concerns and announcements, overview of the August 7th and 8th meeting. Let's go with, does anybody have any correspondence to start with?
I do. So I got, and I gave this to them, I emailed it to Robert, but it was like right before the meeting, so I guess there was some meetings in regards to wildlife services, and there was actually an audit that that found that APHIS Wildlife Services is a necessary and important part of wildlife damage management, so it just is the whole audit, and it just says, following a routine audit of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's, you have this in your email.
Okay.
Okay, just so you know.
I'll distribute a copy later.
Yeah. Anyway, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services, which is known as APHIS, and Wildlife Services Predator Damage Management Program, the U.S. Office of Inspector General, also known as the OIG, found Wildlife Services was in compliance with all applicable federal and state laws. OIG also determined that Wildlife Services was a necessary and important wildlife management program that protects the health and safety of people, animals, and property, as well as wildlife itself. Wildlife Services consistently strives to run a professional, transparent program, said APHIS Administrator Kevin Shea. This audit confirms that we are successfully carrying out our mission of resolving conflicts between humans and wildlife and helping to create a balance that allows coexistence while reducing damage. In the audit, OIG sought to determine if Wildlife Services operations were justified and effective, assess controls over cooperative agreements, examine Wildlife Services information, system reliability, and integrity, and follow up on prior audit recommendations. Wildlife Services complied with all of OIG's requests for information and assistance throughout the audit process. Auditors visited 5 states and 12 district sites and accompanied 40 specialists in the field. They witnessed aerial control operations and fieldwork and spoke with more than 100 program leaders and researchers, state fish and wildlife officials, and property owners. The process did not reveal any systemic problems in the conduct of the control program. Auditors did make recommendations to help Wildlife Services improve its record keeping, and Wildlife Services has issued directives to implement procedures to help alleviate future concerns. Wildlife is a publicly owned natural resource that serves an important public good, but it can also create substantial damages and recurring nuisances. Annually, predators account for the loss of more than 500,000 head of livestock valued at $138 million. Birds cost catfish, rice, and sunflower farmers up to $50 million a year. Most often, those needing help are small producers least able to absorb losses. To mitigate the serious economic impact, Wildlife Services works closely with and at the request of state wildlife agencies, state agriculture departments, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. National Park Service, and many other local, state, and national partners to manage wildlife damage. OIG auditors reported that Wildlife Services experts use a science-based integrated wildlife damage management decision-making model and make decisions in compliance with applicable state and federal laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act, Endangered Species Act, and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Wildlife Services conducts activities to minimize negative impacts to overall native wildlife populations. And I got this from the state director, and just wanted it noted, since that this is what we do, that this is an important part of Wildlife Services.
Okay. Anybody else? Just one thing on. I just wanted to. So, if anybody looks at the state commission's agenda, I just wanted to say why we didn't have a lot of this on there is because we went through this once before. I just want to put that on record. So, I hate doubling up on this stuff. It kind of seems like a waste. So, we'll go on.
Mr. Chair, and I did email Ms. Scorby about this, and the commission wanted to rehear the same issues in Clark County so that they could have direct input. That's the only reason it's redone, and they were cool with us not having to redo. We've got the, if you need the report to take with you, let me know, and okay. Make sure you got it.
Okay. The next thing, unless somebody else has a thing, I just want to say congrats to Endow. I thought this bird book they put together, the small game status is one of the things. This thing is very nice, and I just wanted to give kudos to Randall for putting that thing out. So, and then the other thing is I got a thing about the, I guess they're accepting applications for the Wayne Kirch Award, so I just wanted to throw that out there if somebody has anybody that's they figure should go for that, be up for that. I think they should make a note of it. So I just want to put that out there. So if anybody has anything else, I'll shut that agenda item. Number 6. Okay, we'll go to agenda item number 9. Commission Regulation 16-02, fishing.
Do you want to do the overview of the 7th and 8th meetings?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I got ahead of myself there. Sorry about that.
No worries.
So the overview of the 7th and 8th meeting. Butch?
Chairman Drew and Vice Chairman Wallace were reelected. We had the workshop items were discussed and passed with little comment. That's 454, carrying a firearm during archery and muzzleloader. 455, trapping deadline and license dates. 456, elk arbitration panel. 457, elk incentive tags, a new farm to include spike elks. The informational deals was Nevada hosted the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agency's annual convention, and it was deemed a great success. There was an overview on pond permits, on mining assessment fees, to provide a baseline of understanding for future regulations modification being sought. A good presentation on the fish and drought conditions. A slide presentation on RAS and green tag programs, including the recent change in sales, and they're going to try to move that around a little bit. Humboldt County Elk Management Sub-Plan Steering Committee has held two meetings, and an update will be made available. And Secretary Waskley provided an overview on the recent Endow activities. Deputy Attorney General Ward submitted a summary of the existing legislation. Brian Wakely presented a brief on a new program on the harvest managing, which is going to incorporate a lot of other items so you have a better overall picture, and it'll be made available to the public. Secretary Wassley provided an update on all the existing improvements, and two action items. Regulation 16-01 was approved concerning the waterfowl season limit in public area, and the big game release budget was approved for the reasons of only one, with the reason for only one release in 2006. One comment I have is, you sit there and they bring these up and they say, anybody with the advisory boards, any comment? Well, every one of these we commented on. So you kind of sit there and you kind of look around and nobody else says anything. It looks like we don't do a darn thing. I don't know if you can say we approve that, but I think you're just adding to the meeting by doing it.
Well, I think it's a good thing that, because I get up, when I go to this meeting, I get up on each one and I say, we voted on this 4-1 or 5-0, just to put it in record that, you know, we were up there. So, don't worry about the other county boards, whatever they're going to do, they're going to do. So, I think that's a good thing just to get up and just put it on record that, you know, we're there and listening. So, anybody else have anything?
Well, and Member Spencer, if I can just say, and sometimes we've had things that we didn't agree on, and I'll even say these were the concerns that we had, but here's how our vote went, just so that they know what we were thinking about.
Right,
you know what I mean?
The one before, on the firearms for archery, got up and said that.
Cool.
And we had one other that we didn't agree with. Right. So, I mean, I got up and made that we disagreed.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's what I like to see. So, thanks, Bush. That was very thorough. I like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, now we'll officially close number 6. We'll go on to number 9, Commission Regulation 16-02, Fishing Season and Bag Limits. Did you want to talk, or did you just want us to...
I can talk. It's up to you guys. I can just go over. It's pretty short.
Go ahead.
I know Robert's going to yell at you. Yeah. He's going to, one, want your name, and number 2, I want you to sit up here so you're close to the speakers.
You want to close up there?
Yep.
Right.
Just so tell him.
I have to go back and listen.
I got you.
He's old and he can't hear.
And you are?
Travis Hawks.
TRAVISHAWKES?
KS.
Just KS.
Yes, sir. So, first one is in Humboldt County. We got approved to stock Tiger Muskie in there. The grant actually just got approved, so we can do it.
Where?
Chimney Reservoir. We're going to do it in the springtime, and so we're changing the regulation just to include a zero limit on the Tiger Muskie. We don't want them being caught out before they get to size to actually control the carp, because that's what they're for, their biological control. So further down the road, once they get to size and we have some trophy-sized fish in there, we may open it up to limited take on them.
So. How much water is in there right now?
In Chimney? It's actually fairly full. Okay. If you're familiar with it, it's full up through the Narrows and then into the East Bay. There's no water up there, but it's maintaining.
Is the walleye pretty much dumped out of that?
No, they're still in there, and people have actually been fishing and having good success in there. Okay. But the carp that we did the treatment for 4 years ago, they're starting to turn back up. Yeah. So we're going
to
take a new approach with the tiger muskie. It's worked in other western states, so hopefully we can get some success. Next one is in Lincoln County, Eagle Valley Reservoir. We've seen people targeting the black bass in the springtime when they're spawning. And there's a decent population in there, but they're not getting to be very large. So we're going to change the regulation to no take on the black bass during their spawning periods in April to June 30th. And hopefully we'll increase the number of large bass in the reservoir and more, have more carryover year after year. There's also to reduce confusion, the part above Eagle Valley Reservoir is called Meadow Valley Wash, and we're just including that in the regulation now instead of saying the stream above the reservoir.
Okay. So,
Mineral County, Rose Creek Reservoir is located on Mount Grant. It sits on the Army Depot property, and it's been closed since the 9/11 stuff happened. They recently approached us about opening it back up since Walker Lake, the fishery in there, has pretty much crashed. The people in Hawthorne don't have anywhere to fish. So we agree, we have an agreement with them, and we've started stocking tiger trout in there. We foresee a lot of pressure on it, so we want the limit to just be 3 game fish, period. It used to be that the general regulation, which was 5 trout, 10 whitefish. Though there's no whitefish in there, it's just trout, so...
Is there anything other than tigers?
Not at this time, no.
Okay.
And then in Nye County on Kirch, a lot of stuff to just reduce confusion. Another one where they're targeting the black bass in the springtime. We want to increase the larger fish in there. So, again, we're going to close the season or close take from April 1st to June 30th. And then on all the waters there, they used to be a 25 warm water game fish limit, which is different than the rest of the southern region. The rest of the southern region is 15 warm water game fish. So we're just going to knock it down to the 15 warm water game fish so it's consistent throughout the region. So. And the only other thing was on the very last page, it shows what the Truckee River supposed to be, and it's split. If you read, it says,
yep.
And if we're going to change that, there's no reason to have it split. It should all be the same.
Exactly.
3
yeah.
fish limit, California to the tribal land. So.
Especially since there's no trout in the trophy community anymore.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Take out the public.
Yeah. What did you just say about the Truckee River? Because I think that was one of my main questions.
That was my thing. What they did is there is no trophy section anymore.
Right. So,
so
we're going to reduce
California
that down to one
exactly.
Truckee River from the California state line to the beginning of the reservation.
Yes.
Okay. That was one question I had coming here tonight. The other one is, again, on the Truckee River, but Story County. Truckee River is the border of Washoe and Story County, or a portion of them. And if you'll notice, in Story County, all open waters have 5 trout and 10 mountain whitefish and 15 mm-hmm. warm water.
Yeah.
So if you fish on the north side of the river, because the county line goes to the center of the natural bed, and that's from 1861, that boundary was written. So if you fish on the north side, you're only allowed to keep 3 game fish. You fish on the south side of the river, you're allowed all sorts of fish.
Yeah.
And I think that should be done away with.
Yeah.
It should be consistent no matter what side of the river you're on. So I would suggest that this board review and possibly make that recommendation to change that.
Yeah.
That was it.
Okay. Is that just a miss?
Yeah. That's actually the first time that I've
ever heard about it.
It's just a.
And I don't know how we approach changing that regulation. I guess we just have to include in the Story County saying, except for the Truckee River, where it's a.
We'll just make it free game fish.
Yeah.
Just straight, the Truckee wherever it is.
Right.
So, and we'll make a recommendation to, and they can hack that right there. So, anybody else? Anybody else here have any questions on this? No. Somebody want to make a motion? I'll make a motion. Member Shea will make a motion that we get the Wildlife Commission to accept Commission Regulation 16-02 fishing season and bag limits for 2016 through 2018 as written, with the following exceptions. Under Washoe County, combining the Truckee River into one section, since they're from the California state line to the Pyramid Lake Reservation boundary. And it would be open all year round, three game fish, an hour of the day or any hour of the day or night. And under Story County, under open waters, where the Truckee River is there, it should say, let me see how to put that. Actually, it should have its own thing for the Truckee River, where it says matching open year round, except for closed areas, three game fish, and any hour of the day or night.
There, what is for Washoe?
Yes.
That would be
for the rest of the Truckee River. Okay.
On the Truckee River.
Thank you. On the Truckee River. That's what we did.
Before we second it, are you saying that for all of Story County?
For all the Truckee River. So whatever.
So the Truckee River that's
in Story County is the same.
Okay. Truckee My River. Understanding. Yeah, and let me see if this is right.
Yeah.
You want Washoe and Story County, actually want the Truckee River, no matter what county, to be the same rank all the way down, either side of the river, doesn't matter who.
Correct.
Okay, that's easy.
To mirror Washoe County.
To mirror Washoe County, because that's, okay, from state line to Pyramid Lake.
To the reservation.
To the reservation boundary, okay. Not Pyramid Lake. Okay.
I think we got it.
Well, no, I do have another question.
Okay.
But so does Story County have anywhere else to fish?
That's the only section.
And that's why I'm asking, because if it's only the Truckee River part of it, then...
Well, they got tributaries and stuff, but there's no trout, I don't think, in some of those little tributaries. There's just dates and stuff.
We occasionally will stock them on good water here, but...
So if there's other places in Story County to fish, do we still want to say three game fish?
Because it's all tributaries on the Truckee.
Okay, I'm just...
Yeah. Yeah.
Want to make sure I'm clear
when
I write it. Okay, thank you.
So it's just the Truckee River itself.
Yeah.
And Story County.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that was just a misslip. So.
And so then I'll second. Member Spencer will second.
Okay.
All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. Not hearing it passes. Number 10. Washoe County Advisory Board of Managed Wildlife members and or staff announcements, requests for information, and selection of topics for future agendas.
Any new items I don't know about?
I'm sorry?
Any new items I don't know about?
Not that I can think of. If anybody has anything
anybody
to say.
Else? Okay.
Let's see.
Until about 10 days beforehand, they let me know if you think of something. Once
yeah.
Once we get the draft
yeah.
together.
Yeah, once I see, yeah, I will.
Okay, we'll work on that.
Okay. Number 11, public comments. If anybody has anything to say, please come up, have your name on there and say something. Not seeing any, we'll close that out. Number 12, adjournment. Thank you, guys.